Pleasure to introduce Alex Will. Alex is in the Department of Mathematics at the University of Southern California. And I've known Alex for about 5 years. We've had lots of great discussions about quantum mechanics and quantum logic and all sorts of things. So without further ado.
Thanks, Howard. Okay, so most of you will have been at the talk this morning. It's a pity that they've moved us. I like the other room very much, and here I feel exposed. but the good news is this. I've been told by several people that at certain points during the earlier lecture, chalk was raining down on the audience, and I think you're all further back, so safer. Okay, so this morning we got through perhaps about half of what I'd intended to. Over lunch, I went through my notes and having gotten through about 6 pages of notes this morning, I came up with, probably something like double that for this lecture. And so probably I'll get through about half of this. Let me tell you what I propose to talk about right now. I'm going to move some things around in the interest of getting to the more important topics. So. For talk two, which is this one, I'm going to start off by talking about complements in a lattice and distributivity in a lattice, and the very briefly the notion of a complemented distributive lattice, which is the same thing as a Boolean algebra. And I think then I'm going to talk very briefly about class of lattices that are called modular lattices and what these have to do with classical projective geometry. I'm then going to introduce a notion that's, related to that of a complement, though not quite the same thing, the notion of an orthocomplementation on a lattice. Lattices equipped with what I will call orthocomplementations are called ortholattices. A particular kind of ortholattice satisfying a particular condition is an orthomodular lattice. So we'll talk about those briefly. Condition called orthomodularity. And then that will bring me to Perron's representation theorem. And some of the more recent results that pertain to that. I had thought to talk about Piron's axioms if I mention them at all. It's mostly going to be very, very telegraphically. I won't go into detail about them. I had also promised to tell you about Mackey's axioms, and I think I'm going to put that off to the third lecture tomorrow. So Mackey goes in there, and I think that will fit reasonably well with what I was going to talk about in the third lecture anyway. All right, so let's get back to where we were. We had introduced the notion of a lattice, a partially ordered set, in which every pair of elements has both a meet and a join. I said, I think at one point, that all lattices, indeed all partially ordered sets, were to be assumed to be bounded wherever they needed to be. Well, they kind of need to be here on out. So let's just make the blanket assumption that all lattices are bounded. Unless they need not to be. Okay. I don't think that will happen, but just in case. All right. Here's the definition of a complement in a lattice, or a complement of an element of a lattice. Let's say that L, its partial order, is a lattice. Ooh. L being a lattice. A complement for particular element A in that lattice L is another element B in L such that A meet B is 0, the least element in the lattice, and A join B is 1. So what does this mean? This means that there is no non-trivial element, no element other than 0 that is simultaneously beneath A and B. And there is no element other than the top of the lattice, 1, that's simultaneously above A and B. So let's look at a couple of examples. Feel for this. In the power set of a set X, each element has a unique complement. Set A, X, has unique complement, namely its set theoretic complement, the rest of the set. That's the only set that is simultaneously disjoint from A, which is what this would say in that context, and which would union up with A to fill up the whole set X. On the other hand, in our favorite lattice, lattice of closed subspaces of a Hilbert space, typically an element has many complements. Indeed, infinitely. Yes, infinitely many different complements. No. In fact, let's just look at a three-dimensional real Hilbert space. There's the origin. Let's call this plane M, 0. Well, here's a, this is the time I get to use the colored chalk, right? Good. So here's a complement. one-dimensional subspace. Here's another. Here's another. Indeed, any one-dimensional subspace through the origin not lying in that plane is a complement for that plane. Why? Because in this lattice, remember, the join of two subspaces, it's not their union, it's their span. And the plane, together with a line not lying in that plane, will span all of R3. And of course, the intersection is the trivial subspace, consisting of zero alone, right? So we have infinitely many. Just for contrast, let's look at a chain. Element A has no complements. Element B has no complements. One has a complement. It's zero. Zero has a complement. It's one. But those are the only complemented elements. All right. So it seems that the power set is a little bit special in having this property that every element has a complement, but only one. A lattice with that property is said to be uniquely complemented. The fact that the power set is uniquely complemented is related to the fact that it is distributive. So here's the definition. Distributive. It's distributive. If and only if for all elements lattice, see the following things are true. A meet the join of B and C is equal to A meet B. Join A meet C. Meets distribute over joins. And similarly, joins distribute over meets. A join B meet C is A join B meet A join C. All right, now. The distributive law for unions and intersections, or the distributive laws for unions and intersections, is well known. Everybody learns about that when they first learn a little bit of set theory and play around with Venn diagrams. What's kind of interesting is that distributivity actually implies in any lattice that if an element has a complement, it has only one. Let's see that. Let's prove a little lemma. L is distributive. Each element A in L has at most one complement. The proof is one of those things that's kind of agreeable, sort of fun. Let's take an element A in L, and let's say that B and C, not necessarily distinct, are complements for A. Well then, I'll try to convince you that B equals C. Actually, will you grant me that it's enough if I show you that B is less than or equal to C? Because then, by symmetry, C will have to be less than or equal to B. And by the anti-symmetry of less than or equal to, the two will be the same. All right. So let's see if we can do this. We want to write down B and somehow conclude that it's less than or equal to C. OK. Well, one way in which I can write B in any bounded lattice is as follows. B is the same thing as B join 0. And we said that C was a complement for A. And if C is a complement for A, then A meets C is 0. And reading that backwards, 0 can be written as A meets C, yes? And now we can use the distributive law. Distributing, we have that this is equal to B join A meet B join C. Well, what's B join A? Remembering that B is a complement for A. It's 1. And in any bounded lattice, 1 meet anything you like is that thing you liked. So this is B join C. All right, so we conclude that B equals B join C. And therefore, I guess I've gotten it the other way around from what I said. If B is equal to B join C, that implies C is less than or equal to B. Then reverse the argument, reverse the roles of B and C in the argument. You get it going the other way, right? That's really neat. That's one of those sort of little exercises that you could give your undergraduates to do, but it's much too nice to give away. So I always feel I have to present it. Okay, so complemented. Distributive lattices have this property that complements are unique where they exist. Incidentally, a chain is always distributive. I'll leave that to you to check for yourself. If every pair of elements is comparable, then these two identities each say something fairly trivial, and so you have distributivity. But of course, in a chain, you also have no complements. OK, now, at this point, I can define what is meant by a Boolean algebra. Or at least I can give one of several possible definitions. And maybe properly, I should say, I'm going to define what's called a Boolean lattice, but it comes to the same thing. So definition. Distributive lattice in which every element is a complement to a Boolean. Lattice. Or I know how to draw. You see, it's not good to get too frustrated with it. Let's see what I can find. Or Boolean algebra. I'll sometimes just write BA for short, Boolean algebra. Okay, so what are examples of Boolean algebras? Well, at the moment, we know of only one, a power set. It's not very hard to find more examples by looking inside a power set. By way of example, take an infinite set X, look at all of the subsets of that infinite set that are either finite or that have finite complements. Those are the so-called finite cofinite sets. They form a sublattice of the power set. Intersections of cofinite things are cofinite. Unions of cofinite things are cofinite. And taken as a lattice in their own right, they're distributive because the ambient power set is distributive. And they're complemented because of the way I set things up. Everything in there has its complement. So that's a Boolean algebra. That's not all of the power set. OK, so certain sub-Boolean algebras of power sets can be brought forward as other examples. Are there any more? Are there any other Boolean algebras that don't arise just as sublattices of a power set, complemented sublattices of a power set? The answer is no. It's an old theorem. Birkhoff, I believe, that every Boolean algebra is isomorphic to a sub-Boolean algebra of a power set for some set X. By a sub-Boolean algebra, I just mean a sublattice that's got all the complements. Has the complement of in it of everything else that's in it. It's closed under complements. Well, a natural question then is, can we go further? Can we bring forward a sharper result that will characterize not just sub-Boolean algebras of the power set, their complemented distributive lattices, but characterize power sets on the nose? And the answer there is yes.
There's an even better theorem, also due to Birkhoff.
Colored chalk is tougher, so I will probably switch to yellow. Theorem, also due to Birkhoff. Let L be a complete atomistic. I'm going to explain in just a second what these terms mean. Complete atomistic Boolean algebra. Then L is actually isomorphic to a power set. So what does it mean for lattice to be complete? L is complete just in case every subset of the lattice, not just two element subsets, every subset has a join, a least upper bound, and a meet, a greatest lower bound. So I won't write down the definition formally, but it's the natural extension of the definition I gave earlier of meets and joins for two elements. L is complete if for every set L, rather every set A contained L, both the meet of A, the join of A exist in L. And L is atomistic if and only if every element A in L is a join of atoms. Very good. What's an atom? An atom in any poset, at least in any poset with a zero element, is a minimal non-zero element of the lattice, something that covers zero. Right? In this case, you can actually take the set X to be the set of atoms. Yeah, but in this case, that's correct. The first theorem says there exists some X, and you can actually say more than that. I could tell you what X could be, but I don't want to go into the details. But if you're curious, please ask me afterwards. In the case of this theorem, I'll tell you specifically, you can take it to be the set of atoms. All right, so this is all pretty satisfactory. We have a complete lattice theoretic characterization of power sets. Well, so a question that should arise at this point is there a comparably nice, clean lattice theoretic characterization of the lattice of subspaces of a Hilbert space? So let's just frame that question. Characterization
of lattices of the form
L of H. What must such a lattice look like? Well, I'm going to return to this question in a little bit, but before I do, I want to take a quick look at the lemma we proved of a little bit ago that said that in a distributive lattice, complements, if they exist, are unique. I want to go back to that point and make a few observations. In view of our earlier lemma, none of the following are distributive. Here are some non-distributive lattices that you can easily recognize as non-distributive just by observing that they contain elements with multiple complements. Here's one that we saw a little while ago. Warning. Let's say that's A. Here's B. Here's C. Oh, well, A meet B is 0. And A join B is 1. And ditto, A meets C. And A joins C are 0 and 1, respectively. So A has two distinct complements, one above the other. Here's another, in a way, even simpler example. It should be evident that any two of those elements, A, B, and C, are complements. And then here, finally, is a third. L of H is not distributive. You can show that L of H is not distributive reasonably straightforwardly, but certainly the easiest way to see that it's non-distributive is just to look at the damn thing and see, ooh, lots of multiple complements, can't be distributive. Okay. Well, so if this is not distributive, then I guess a natural question to ask, if we're ultimately hoping to find a characterization of it, is what nice properties does it have? What nice lattice theoretic properties can we bring forward that L of H does have? Well, here's one. At least if it's finite dimensional. If it's finite dimensional, then it's got a very nice property called modularity. And I think I'll tell you a little bit about that right now. Definition: lattice L is modular, just in case it has the following property: that if you give me three elements, A, B, and C, in L, and if it turns out that C is less than or equal to A, then the following special case of the distributive law holds, that A, let's see if I get this right, probably won't, so I'll look. Yeah. That A meet B join C is equal to A meet B join C. Almost like a funny kind of associative law, where you can shift the parentheses even though the two operations are not the same. Notice that this is a special case of the distributive law. If we were to apply the distributive law here, we would get A meet B join A meet C. But since C is less than or equal to A, A meet C is in fact C. So this is what you would get if the lattice were distributive in this case. But as we're going to see, there are lattices that are not distributive in which this restricted distributive law still holds. In fact, let's take a look right now at such an example. I want you to let V be any vector space. Any vector space over any field. I don't care even whether it's infinite dimension. I'm going to let, I guess there's no standard notation for this, I tend to write it this way, L0 of V for the set of all subspaces. This set of all M's, which are subspaces of V. Now, notice, if V happens to be some kind of topological vector space, here I'm considering even very pathological non-closed subspaces. Let me look at all the subspaces whatsoever without any attention to any topological properties that they might have or fail to have. I claim that this is a lattice. And it's a lattice with meet and join that we can compute as follows. Given two subspaces M and N, their meet is just what you think. It's their intersection. Their join is their span. And I don't need to close up because I don't care about topological properties. Notice that when you take the span of two subspaces, you can always express that as follows. It's the sum of the two subspaces, that meaning the set of all vectors that you can decompose as a sum of a vector from the first and a vector in the second. All right, so I'm going to work with that formulation. The join is the sum of the subspaces. I claim that this lattice is modular. That is, if we have three subspaces, let's say M, N, and maybe Q, since I've used P for a poset, if Q, say, is a subspace of M, then, let's just translate that statement, then M intersect N join Q, but that would be the same thing as N plus Q, I claim, is equal to M intersect N plus Q. That's what the modular law comes to in this setting. Now, before I prove that, let me point something out about the modular law. I actually claim that the modular law is, as stated, half trivial. By that I mean that of these two inequalities, both of which the statement asserts hold, one of them holds in any lattice. Well, let's consider. If C is less than A, as we've assumed, it's certainly less than B join C. That's going to be above C. And A meet B is also beneath A. And it's beneath B, and therefore beneath B join C. So each term on the right is less than or equal to each term on the left. And therefore, the largest, so therefore, the join of these two is less than each of these two. So this inequality always holds any lattice. And all the meat of the modular law is in the other inequality. So that's really the only one I ever need to check. So let's try to check that here. We're really trying to show that is correct, that inclusion holds. So suppose we have a vector in here. Let's let x be in M intersect N plus Q. Since x has to be in N plus Q, x has to have the form little n plus little q, little n in big N, little q. Big Q, and it also has to be an element of M. OK, now consider. Little q belongs to big Q, but big Q by assumption is a subspace of big M. So by virtue of being in Q, it's little q is also in M. And so X is in M, Q is in M. It follows that their difference is in M.
This implies that X minus Q, which of course is N, is also in M.
Right? Well, therefore, X has what form? It's the sum of an element little n that's in both m and n with an element q, little q that's in q. So that makes it in this guy on the right. And that's the argument. That's all. OK? Let me pause and ask at this point if there are any questions. Did everybody except for the sleepy Chris Fuchs follow that? All right. Now, here's an observation we should probably make at this point. I really used almost nothing in that argument. Almost nothing. In particular, V did not really have to be a vector space over a field. It could just as well have been a vector space, so to speak, over some other kind of ring than a field. Vector spaces over rings are more traditionally called modules. So this is true for any module, that the set of all submodules of a, say, left module of a ring is modular, hence the name modular. Of course, a special case of a module over a ring is any abelian group, which is a module over the ring of integers. So this would work for any abelian group. It also works, for that matter, for the normal subgroups of a group with a little tinkering. So there are lots of lattices that are modular. Of course, we're not interested in lattices that are isomorphic to just the subgroups of an abelian group. We're interested in lattices that are isomorphic to something like this, ultimately. So let's see what else we can obtain. It is a remarkable result, which I'm not going to go into in detail, but a theorem that goes back a long way. This actually has its roots in very classical projective geometry. Names associated with this are, I think a lot of this is actually probably due to Veblen. Maybe Baer had a hand in it, and other people as well. Let L be a heat atomistic modular lattice with two additional properties. It has to be of finite height. I'm not going to pause to write the definition on the board. What I mean by that is, if you look at a chain in this lattice, it can't be infinitely long. And indeed, there has to be a soup, a maximum value to the length of any such chain. All chains finite and of bounded length. And secondly, it has to satisfy something that is usually called the atomic covering law. The AC for short. And I will say what that is. The atomic covering law is this condition. If X is an atom,
and X is not already underneath an element A, then X join A isn't just bigger than A, it covers A. So that there's nothing in between. Let me give you an example. Unfortunately, I erased my pretty picture of a moment ago, but you remember we had a plane, the origin, that's M. Take a one-dimensional subspace, not in that plane. One-dimensional subspaces in a finite-dimensional setting are the atoms in a subspace lattice. There's nothing between the zero subspace and the one-dimensional subspaces. The span of this atom, maybe this is X. This guy, actually, let's call that A. X join A would be the span of A union X, which is just A plus X in this setting. And it's clear just by counting dimension that there isn't anything in between, right? A subspace intermediate between A and A join X would have to have a dimension between that of A and that of A plus 1, and there isn't anything. That's just a sketch, but that gives you a sense of why this atomic covering law is apt to be true for subspace lattices. The theorem is that if you have a complete atomistic modular lattice with this atomic covering law, then there exists not necessarily a field, but at least a skew field, that is a division ring. Right? A ring that's just like a field, except the multiplication might not be commutative. Call it D for skew field, for division ring. And a module, let's just agree to say vector space, V over D, such that L is isomorphic as a lattice to the lattice of all the subspaces of V. Now, because I've assumed the lattice has finite height, it's not very hard to show that in this case V is going to have to be finite dimensional. So the dimension of V here is actually going to be the height, the length of a maximal chain, minus the 0 and the 1, I guess, in L. All right, that's sort of the big coordinatization theorem of classical projective geometry, or at least a version of it. Incidentally, I sort of realized in the middle of writing this down that I've assumed actually a little bit more than is strictly necessary here. If memory serves, in the context of a complete atomistic lattice of finite height with the atomic covering law. Covering law maybe implies modularity. That's sort of in the back of my mind. So this may be a little more strongly stated than strictly necessary, but it will serve for our purposes. Yeah, go ahead. Finite dimensions is important. Because I'm trying to be careful. Yeah, there are infinite dimensional versions of this that are not very much stronger than this. I might need something about it being complemented, something like this. I hope I don't need it here. I think I do. Okay, so we have this classical theorem. The main point to take away here is that an ingredient is this atomic covering law. Well, all right. Now, that might suggest that we're on sort of the cusp of solving this problem. But there's a difficulty. The difficulty is just this. The lattice of closed subspaces of a Hilbert space is not a sublattice of the lattice of all subspaces. I'll come back to that point in a minute, but there's a question. Go ahead. A skew field is an old-fashioned term for a division ring. And a division ring is a ring in which if the product, think of it this way. It's a ring in which every non-zero element has a multiplicative inverse, but in which the multiplication might not be commutative. Okay, and there are lots of examples, although it's a classical result that a finite division ring is actually a field.
How will that be from the rack?
Yeah, I see your point, and I should probably have an immediate answer. Let me think about it afterwards, yeah. Maybe it has to be everything has a left inverse and a right inverse. Well, no, that can't be, because then they'd be the same. So, at any rate. Yeah, in fact, I got that totally wrong. Thank you. So let me rephrase. It's a ring in which if A times B is zero, then either A is zero or B is zero. Right. Like that. And actually that's important. You can't always divide. And so for this reason, actually, if you have a vector space over such a ring, you might not be able to normalize things. This is actually a point I was going to come back to, so thank you for the comment. This actually will turn out to be important. Okay. Okay, so I was just trying to make the point that a little bit of an impediment to using a result like that to try to get a characterization of L of H in some infinite dimensional setting where, without going into details, maybe we imagine that we've found an infinite dimensional version of this statement, is that L of H is not a sublattice of L0 of H. The reason is that in L of H, where H is infinite dimensional, the join is defined differently. I have to close the span. Because it's not a sublattice, it is not obvious, it's not trivial at any rate, that L of H, where H is infinite dimensional, should be modular. It should be clear that a sublattice of a modular lattice will always be modular. You just inherit that property. But L of H isn't a sublattice of L0 of H, and in fact, it isn't modular in infinite dimensions. That ultimately comes down to the fact that in an infinite dimensional Hilbert space, you can find two closed subspaces whose sum is not closed. Leveraging that, you can get a counterexample of the modular law. I'm not going to produce one right here, but I worked for it. Okay, so if it's not modular, what is it? Well, it turns out that even though it's not modular, it has a very nice property called orthomodularity, which I'm going to tell you about in just a second. And I better do it in just a second, since I've only got about 7 minutes left. Let me talk first about the notion of an orthocomplementation on a lattice. L of H is not uniquely complemented, and so it can't be distributed. But in spite of the fact that a typical subspace has many, many complements, there is, in a Hilbert space, in an inner product space, a way of picking out one of those complements as privileged. That's the orthogonal complement. Abstractly, an orthocomplementation is just a way of picking out a preferred complement in a nice way. To be precise, orthocomplementation on any lattice L is a mapping prime, let's call it, from L to L, which has the following properties. First of all, we require that if A is less than or equal to B, then B prime is less than or equal to A prime. The orthocomplementation reverses the order. Secondly, A meet A prime is zero. You need not state it as part of the definition, but it follows, it will follow from this, that A join A prime is one. So we are going to be picking out a complement for each element. And then the final condition is that if you orthocomplement something twice, you don't change it. Everything is its own double orthocomplement. The example that motivates the terminology and that's important for us is this one. On L of H, the mapping M maps to M perp is an orthocomplementation. That's all those properties that you can easily check. Okay, a lattice with a specified orthocomplementation is, wait for it, an orthocomplemented lattice. or an ortho lattice for short. The lattice specified ortho complementation. Time being very limited, and since I do want to at least write down Perron's theorem, I won't give you an example, but it's easy for you to make up little finite examples of lattices that don't admit any ortho complementation, because there just isn't any reasonable way to select a unique complement or a preferred complement so that these conditions are satisfied. So it's a non-trivial statement about a lattice that it admits an ortho complementation. It's also the case that a given lattice may admit many ortho complementations. And in fact, a simple example of this is the following. Take your favorite inner product space, change the inner product. Now you have a different ortho complementation. I won't write it on the board, but there's a theorem due to Birkhoff and von Neumann that says, in a sense, that that's the only way that you can get an ortho complementation on the lattice of subspaces of a vector space by introducing an inner product. That's a kind of rough gloss, but that's essentially what it says. Okay, so in particular, L of H, though not complemented, is ortho-complemented. Let me introduce a little tiny bit of notation, and then I will be able to state the ortho-modular law. Well, actually, now that I think of it, I won't even introduce the notation. I'll just get right to it. Definition. An ortholattice, L prime less than or equal to, is orthomodular if and only if it satisfies this condition for every pair of elements A and B in L. If A is less than or equal to B, then B is equal to B meet A prime join A. If you think about this as though these were sets, this would be trivial. It says if I intersect B with the complement of A, take A away from B, and then union that with the smaller set A, I'll get B back. Okay. Again, it's a weak version of the distributive law. L of H is orthomodular even when it's not modular, even in infinite dimensions. That is, it's what we will start abbreviating this way in tomorrow's talk. It's an OML, orthomodular lattice. In 1964, Constantin Perron proved the following rather deep generalization of the now erased ancient projective geometry theorem. It's this. Let L be a complete atomistic orthomodular AC lattice, meaning lattice satisfying that atomic covering that I mentioned before, of height, I guess it has to be greater than or equal to 4, just to avoid some pathological cases of different dimensions, and let it also be irreducible. Without writing down the formal definition, irreducible just means that the lattice is not a direct product of simpler such lattices. It's a kind of simplicity condition. The punchline is that if L should have all of these wonderful properties, then there exists a division ring D, an involution on the division ring. What's an involution? Well, think of complex conjugation. It's a mapping from the ring to itself that reverses order, and when applied twice, does nothing. So there's an involutive division ring, D, and there is a vector space, I'm going to call it H. And an inner product. By an inner product, I mean something that is formally an inner product with respect to this ring of scalars and with respect to this involution. So it behaves like the complex inner product, it's sesquilinear. Such that the original lattice L is isomorphic to what I'm going to call L of H. Now, since the ring here can be, at least a priori, not the reals or the complexes or the quaternions, I have to say what I mean by L of H. I mean here this. It's the set of subspaces M in this vector space H that are equal to their own double orthocomplements, where perp here means perp with respect to this inner product. That inner product gives you a notion of orthogonality on the vector space. You can look at all the vectors orthogonal to a given subspace and do that twice. This is a sort of algebraic stand-in for the notion of closure, for the notion of topological closure in this possibly non-topological setting. All right, now, question. What kind of a ring can this be? And under what conditions is this sufficient to give us actually a real honest-to-God Hilbert space? There is a companion theorem. A really neat one, actually, due to Amamiya and Araki, I think in 67, who proved that if you choose the scalar field to be the reals or the complexes or the quaternions, say that again? No, I'm saying if you choose D, that's a hypothesis in the theorem. Wait for the conclusion. If that's the case, in other words, if you have an example of this structure with D, one of these fields, then the H that you have here is complete with respect to the inner product. So that this really does mean closed. And you are, in fact, in the desired setting. It's important that in this theorem, what's really in play is the orthomodularity of this lattice. You can find examples of vector spaces over division rings that have nice semi-definite positives, well, not positive, but semi-definite, or definite inner products, such that that lattice of double closed subspaces is not orthomodular. The orthomodularity that gives you the completeness. This is where the matter stood. That's as far as anyone was able to get, at least in the way of very decisive results, for decades. In 1995, I guess her doctoral dissertation, a young mathematician by the name of Maria Soler proved an additional result. If the vector space H that appears in Perron's theorem has an infinite orthonormal basis, then, in fact, the division ring has to be one of those three. Now, remember that having an orthonormal basis is not so trivial in a situation where you can't necessarily normalize. So there is some punch to this assumption. In particular, it's not clear that it's a purely lattice theoretic assumption, because it refers directly to the underlying vector space. Soler does have a purely lattice theoretic formulation. It's a little bit technical. There's a later one that I think is nicer due to a French mathematician by the name of Maillet. Close with this. This is, I think, from 98, at least when it was announced. if there exist in H two elements, that is two subspaces, let's call them M and N, an automorphism alpha of the ortholattice L. By an automorphism, I mean a bijective map that preserves meets, joins, and orthocomplements, with the following properties. First of all, dimension of N should be, I guess, greater than 2. Maybe that's greater than or equal to, but to be safe, I'll say greater than 2. And alpha of Q, let's say, equals Q for every subspace Q less than or equal to N. So you've got one subspace of suitably high dimension so that the automorphism fixes everything under everything inside that subspace, every other subspace below that one. And two, the automorphism maps the other subspace M properly into itself, maps it to a proper subspace of itself. These conditions are equivalent, in fact, to, but I'll just say imply, that that the ring R, pardon, the ring D is R, H, or C. And of course, this condition here isn't going to be satisfied in finite dimensions. So this is a characterization of infinite dimensional Hilbert lattices. OK, which is about as much as I know about the subject. That's sort of as far as my own expertise goes, or as recent as I'm current. Some people have mentioned to me that they've seen still more recent things that seem to them a little sharper, but I can't comment on this. I'm over time by about 7 minutes, and I appreciate your patience in waiting. That's where I'll end here, and we'll continue with more to do with axiomatics, trying to justify some of these axioms on a priori grounds tomorrow. Thanks very much. And I'll wait if people have questions, but feel free to leave if you're anxious to get to the next talk. Okay. It can even be countable because even something like little l2 has these properties. It's really an infinite statement. They almost certainly do, although it's kind of an open question, I guess, whether octonionic or more generally quaternionic quantum mechanics should really be considered.